This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachowiak. Voter ID is swiftly making its way through the legislature this week. It's one of many bills proposed to change the way we vote, who is able to vote, and when we can vote, all of that at stake. But aside from that voter ID bill and a handful of others, the legislature has actually been moving fairly slowly this week, and that is due in part to the shock and grief over the murder of Raleigh political strategist Jamie Hahn. Mark Binker joins us to talk about this week in the legislature. Mark is a multimedia investigative reporter at WRAL-TV. Mark Binker, welcome. Thanks for being here. Tell us what the legislature looked like, because voter ID certainly has been in the headlines long enough, and now it's it gets to the floor. What does it look like in the House?
It actually looks like a bill that the Republican majority will very much tell you, look, we listen to your concerns. We understand there is a population of people out there who do not want to see this bill. We, as in the Republicans, ran on putting a voter ID requirement in place, and we're going to do it, and you're going to object to that, but we're going to make it as sort of a nod to your side as we can. So they did things like making sure there were measures to allow for free IDs, allowing for elderly people to use IDs that were valid on their 70th birthday. And so they took some steps to do it. That said, you still saw the opposition say, hey, this amounts to a poll tax. You saw actually this kind of interesting fight over college kids in the sort of final throes of the discussion, where a college student who goes to UNC will be able to use their university ID if they go to the polls. But a college student who goes to Duke or in another private college wouldn't be able to use that private institution ID to vote. And that was seen as a bit of unfairness there.
What about the protest? Is that over, and was it still in evidence this week?
Oh, the protest was still there, and it's being led in large measure by the state chapter of the NAACP. You saw Reverend William Barber talking about this immediately after the bill passed the House. Actually, we were expecting 2 days of floor debate on this measure, and sort of it goes through on the first day, and I think people had maybe worn themselves out because it's been in committee after committee, and it's been talked about for so long. You got to this point where the vote was taken, and you were expecting to hear what we political geeks were listening for was an objection to third reading, and nobody raises the objection. And, you know, Speaker Tillis almost sounds surprised when he says, well, I guess we'll go ahead and vote it through. So now it's into the state Senate's hands.
All right. And there were other voting-related bills that have not gone to the floor yet. What do those look like? What are they?
You've seen bills that would limit the early voting period. You've seen bills to address sort of absentee voting. The sort of theme that opponents of these measures would have you draw is that they are in some way limiting the ability of certain constituencies that might find themselves friendly to Democrats rather than Republicans to vote. One of the reasons that you haven't seen a lot of these other measures moving is, as far as elections and voting go, voter ID has eaten up all the bandwidth. I mean, it's been just such a huge footprint on the legislature that these other bills haven't gotten a lot of hearings. So it's really not clear right now what else along those lines are going to move.
And there are some fundamentally different kinds of bills. Voter ID, for instance, doesn't restrict the number of people. Everybody who can vote now, if they get an ID, can vote tomorrow. There is at least one piece of legislation that would reduce the number of voters, at least for 5 years, and that would be for people who have been convicted of felonies who would now, or if the legislation should pass and be signed, would have to wait 5 years.
Yeah, and that's a change from it now. And it's not actually an easy thing for a felon to go and have their voting rights restored. I mean, it may be one of those things that's sort of top of mind for you as somebody, just sort of going about your daily business. But, people who are out of jail and trying to make their way in the world, it may not be top of mind for them to go and try to get those voting rights restored until there is an election that comes up. Again, that's part of these, the set of bills that has to do with voting that we haven't seen move that may get underway, but that debate hasn't taken place yet.
All right. Well, like a lot of people, lawmakers certainly in shock over the murder of Jamie Hahn. Tell us about the case.
This was something came through on Monday night. Actually, I found out about it because a call from my wife said, hey, there's a bunch of police in our neighborhood. We live about 3 blocks away from where this happened. And we found out that there was a stabbing on Monday night, that a husband and wife were stabbed and that the suspect was injured. We found out that it was Jamie and Nation Hahn, two people actively involved in Democratic politics, and that their friend, Jonathan Wayne Broyhill, was the suspect. And, you know, this was shocking to people in the neighborhood. It was shocking to people in the community because Mr. Broyhill and the Hahns were seen as very good friends. Mr. Broyhill worked for Jamie Hahn. There was a lot of, well, holy cow, how did this happen? Mrs. Hahn dies over the in the early hours of Wednesday morning. And we begin to see this storyline evolve where, well, the FEC, the Federal Elections Commission, had questioned refunds from Brad Miller's campaign, and Mrs. Hahn's company, Blue Sky, had done work for Brad Miller's campaign, where there were these refunds that didn't match the amount of contributions that were given to the campaign. And the FEC basically said, you know, purely as an accounting thing, hey, what's going on here? What looks like happened is this tipped Mrs. Hahn off to the fact that perhaps Mr. Broyhill was doing refunds, and instead of those refunds making it to the donors, something else was happening with them. My colleague Laura Leslie has actually talked to at least the donors involved that the FEC flagged, and they've said, look, we didn't get those checks back. So something was going on there. It's very tempting. It actually seems likely now that discovery led to the incident on Monday night. You can't say that for 100% yet.
Certainly part of the investigation.
But it's part of the investigation. It's part of what we've heard from the police that, yeah, this is what we're looking at.
So what impact has that had on the legislature this week in terms of their business?
Not a lot. They didn't have to take a break in order to go in. All the sort of the visitation and the funerals happening tonight and this weekend. So you didn't really see a break from the pace of legislating. They didn't have to take a time out. But you definitely it was a topic of discussion. It was shocking. You know, the Hahns are people who are very much viewed. Yeah, they were on this side of the ledger, but they were not caustically so. They were you know, happy warriors in the best sense of that term. And it came as a shock to both Republicans and Democrats that something like this could happen.
Well, certainly on our minds at the national scale are the Boston bombings. And as that probe continues, we've been wondering about the coverage of this story and how it affects us individually and collectively. Accuracy certainly has suffered in the interest of speed in getting this story out from time to time. Instant communication through social media and the willingness of mainstream media outlets to use social media has added to the problem. Talk to us, Mark, about some of the mistakes and kind of from the insider's point of view, what the pressures on reporters to get this stuff out quickly, use social media, and then, you know, make mistakes.
Well, you know, the first thing I should say is, you know, Boston's a long way away. So WRL was not engaged in, you know, frontline coverage, with the exception of Kelsey Carlson, who's one of our morning anchors, actually ran in the Boston Marathon, finished the race about an hour before the bombs went off, and then turned around and started reporting from up there, which, gosh, she's a better reporter than I. I think I would have collapsed after running a marathon. But, you know, from a news consumer's perspective, you know, what I very much wanted is, okay, I want you to tell me what's happening. I want you to tell me why it's happening. I want you to have that right. And, you know, I think the biggest thing that sticks in my mind is watching the CNN broadcast and saying, oh, we have a suspect in custody, when there was no suspect in custody. You know, that's just journalism 101. And, you know, that had me flashing back to other errors that had been made along that line by cable news networks. And
well, and let me interrupt your train of thought, but the fact that we're all on now 24 hours a day and feel the need to fill that time makes it sort of an imperative that we have something to say.
Although, you know, we're not all on all of that time. And actually, I think that not to, you know, log roll the folks in my business, but, you know, you saw the network coverage, the CBSs, the NBCs of the world, with news operations, maybe do a little bit better because, you know, they're still producing newscasts, they're still out in news gathering, they're in the business of you know, collecting facts. CNN, because it's on 24 hours a day, is so much in the business now of sort of opining on stories that when this kind of incident hits, it looked to me like they had a hard time switching from punditry to, oh, we need to go switch the switch all the way to hard news gathering. And it seemed like they were just unable to get out of that trench that they're dug into.
What about the impact of social media? We know those networks exist. People can talk with each other on Twitter and other social media and send around photos and opinions. But now mainstream media, we're all using it, and we're using it the minute it comes in. What kind of impact is that having on accuracy?
Well, I mean, if you ask the editors at the New York Post, I'm sure they might say it has a lot, because they ran a front page cover identifying somebody who had nothing to do with the bombings, who was later found dead as one of the potential bombers. Look, you know, journalism is journalism. This need for information, this want for information has always been there. In the old days, you know, your paper would run a special afternoon edition, or you would break into broadcast. And now there are these other outlets that allow for things that aren't necessarily as vetted as they should be to make it out there. And the responsibility of news producing organizations is the same as it ever was, to sort out what we can verify, what we know, what we think we know, but we're still working on, and what we can say, hey, this is not right. And that sifting needs to go on. And obviously, in a few cases, it didn't go on well enough.
Well, let's talk about what happens when that doesn't happen and what effect it has on our idea about the story as we move forward. We're going to take a break right now and come back and talk with Mark Binker, a multimedia investigative reporter at WRAL. And then we'll be joined by Jules Odenall James. She's a resident dramaturg at Duke University. And Omid Safi is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And we'll talk about the impact this has on our impressions going forward and what it does to our criminal justice system and the social fabric as well. When we get it wrong to begin with, does it stick? Can we change our minds? What impact does it have? You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, reflecting on the Boston Marathon bombing and the media's performance in a time of crisis, Mark Binker is with us, multimedia investigative reporter at WRAL-TV. And I'm joined now by Jules Odenall. I got that right. Odenall James is a resident dramaturg visiting lecturer at Duke University. Omid Safi is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And they're here to tell us, you know, sort of how this coverage, we're bound to make mistakes, and we do, but it happens in a big way and it gets amplified quickly. Jules, as a dramaturg, talk about media as social drama, sort of how it plays on the imagination.
Right. Actually, the chair of the cultural anthropology department at Duke, Oren Starn, had a piece in the Huffington Post and invoked Victor Turner's notion of social drama. And in that sense, that social dramas provide us a set of sort of scripted roles and narratives and rituals to go through, especially in the face of trauma. And those are very important because they help us feel like we know what's going on and how to respond. And that can produce sort of community cohesion after something terrible happens, but it also can produce an idea of what we think we know about it and then actions out of that idea. And it also obscures other narratives. Let's say, so we focus on terrorism from the outside, and we don't apply terrorism to some of the actions that our government might be taking in other places. And so terrorism becomes a sort of convenient placeholder, and so we start to behave accordingly, whether we have all the facts or not.
So we use these types and stereotypes as shorthands and quick ways of getting a handle on something that's going to take us a long time truly to put together.
And theater provides us a very convenient vocabulary, everything from the script, right, the staging of the event, the staging of the bombing at an event that was a peaceful sort of international sport event, the actors casting those actors and how complicated that became once they were not overtly dark-skinned, but then attached ethnically and religiously to our sort of notion of the terrorist that has emerged post 9/11. The sort of conversations that we would have about what our response would be, and as well as then our performances in response to that, whether we obsess and allow this to be a very large event on the scale of 9/11, whether it becomes sort of part and parcel of our worry on an everyday level, whether we put that into, or whether we start to look critically at it as what is different about this event, tied to maybe them being American citizens, not necessarily just from the outside. So what role do we have to play in the construction of their lives, their response, and our response to them?
And Omid Safi, you have thought deeply about and written about the fact that we have latched on to their religion, their Islamic religion, and this word terrorism quite quickly and the impact that that's had.
Yes, thank you. And, you know, I think as we are now in a situation of having this round-the-clock conversation and news analysis about it, terrorism has become this placeholder that this narrative that explains, as it were, actions that, frankly, we don't understand right now. If one of the definitions of terrorism is politically motivated attacks on civilians, we are at the very rudimentary stages of understanding why these two suspects might have engaged in such actions. And I think some of the questions that other people are asking is terrorism action that is directed at American citizens only when it's committed by certain people, specifically Muslims in this case? And if that's the case, then, you know, did we and should we use the word terrorism for Adam Lanza in the Sandy Hook context, or do we put that aside as some kind of mental illness or derangedness, psychopathy, or whatever? Did we use terrorism in Aurora? Did we use terrorism in Virginia Tech? Or do we have a separate vocabulary? And if you have a separate vocabulary, then does that not betray something about the assumptions that we have about this mega word, terrorism?
And again, from the dramatic standpoint, from the way it works on our imagination, Jules, these embedded ideas that carry so much dramatic weight, terrorism, foreign threat, right? They're just a lot easier to hold on to, aren't they? Or is that not how it works?
Absolutely. We want our crime easy to solve and also easy to pinpoint its cause and effect. That's one of the reasons linear narrative and sort of documentary storytelling are so compelling to us, because we think we're getting a notion of the real. And if this A happens, then B happens, then C happens, that's very helpful, except A, then Z, then Q, right? Where the facts on the ground are very chaotic. I actually sort of write on the notion of the forensic in relationship to this, forensic science being the thing that we really have come to attach a particular kind of material truth to. But there's also forensic argumentation, which is this notion of being able to put a set of facts in motion that helps support material evidence. And the problem with forensic argumentation is that's you don't have to wait for the things to happen in court. You can start to build that narrative outside of what might be allowed in a court, what might become the ultimate outcome of this case that will be vetted by legal systems and structures and rules that we have in there. But in the court of public opinion, other stories, in fact, that's why it's so effective as a true crime genre, because true crime implies that we're getting a real story. Right. In the courtroom, you weren't allowed to hear this. Now we'll tell you the truth. And that is then filled with all kinds of presumptions and dramatic events that is about sort of managing our fear and getting us to think, okay, no, that happened, then that person was caught, these people provided us justice, and now we can close it.
Well, and there's a lot of myth-making even in this forensic process, while the gathering process and the presentation may be partly forensic, scientific, and logical. Ask any attorney. They don't want logic when they go to present this to a jury. They're going to tell a story, and they're going to frame it in a way that's going to have an effect on the emotions of that jury. They don't want them to be analysts. In fact, ask a lot of researchers how often they get rejected from juries, because once they find you have an analytic mind, they don't want you on the jury.
And you have to think about how difficult it is to rewrite yourself out of a criminal narrative. The Central Park Five, there was just a documentary this month premiered on PBS about the Wilding episode and the rape in Central Park and the young men who were convicted in a court of law that were innocent of this. And I'm not implying that the Tsarnaev brothers, right, there's more to that story that we don't know. But seeing that story and how difficult it was for them to write themselves out of a narrative that began from the moment that event was reported exists to this day, exists to what they can be and do even after exoneration. Exonerated prisoners, I think, experience this all the time. So when we get something wrong, it's not that it's just a little fact that it gets wrong. It's then put into a larger narrative that moves in a space that we have a very hard time dissecting the complexity out of, and also changing once we do know what the facts
right.
are.
Right. And certainly Americans didn't begin attacking Americans when Timothy McVeigh attacked the Oklahoma City, you know, federal building, or people whose names began with MC. But that has happened in the Muslim community.
It has, and there are numbers of, you know, episodes in Massachusetts and other states where people have been targeted. And I think even more importantly than the individuals who have been targeted is actually what is happening to our national discourse. And one of the things that I'm terribly concerned about is when we allow ourselves to get to the point of eroding what actually makes this a very special place to live. So on one hand, we have people like Lindsey Graham who are talking about this person should be treated like an enemy combatant. And, you know, the governor of the state talks about, well, before his Miranda rights have been read, we want to ask him a million questions. And then we're supposed to sit and applaud the fact that, okay, he finally got his Miranda rights. He's an American citizen. He is already endowed with those rights, whether or not they read it to him. Those are rights that are his. And he should be prosecuted like any criminal is, and if he's found guilty, then so be it. And many FBI experts are saying, let's call him what he is, if he's found guilty of that, a murderer. And what a different tone that has than terrorist. And I think one of the questions that I want to ask in a time like this, keeping in mind all the sensitivity and prayer and grief for the victims of the Boston Marathon explosion, is we're talking about four human beings who were killed and about 180 who were injured. We have 30 to 40,000 people every year who are killed by gun violence. We have, in the same weekend, other people who are killed in the Texas explosion. We have five people who are killed in Seattle. None of those murders trigger a billion-dollar national expenditure and tens of thousands of police people running around, and this paranoid conversation about this foreign threat and let's close off the national borders and change our immigration policies. So quite apart from what this says about terrorism and Muslims and the rights of Muslims, I actually care about having this conversation of what does this say about America? What does this say about our American civic notions and the rights and privileges and responsibilities that all of us are already entitled to?
Well, Mark Pinker is a reporter, and as you pointed out, certainly WRAL was not on the front lines of this story, but you as a reporter have been in the position of covering huge stories that have an impact. They're breaking the information scattered all over. And then these phrases start to build in. Suddenly terrorist is in all the copy you're reading. What's the pressure on a reporter and editors to sort of make the judgment that this word has made its way into the copy and needs to come out until we've, you know, sort of thought about this more deeply? There's a lot of pressure on all of us, isn't there?
I guess there's social pressure. And one of the phrases I heard from Amit earlier, national conversation, one of the problems is we're having less and less of a national conversation. 30 years ago, we sort of all swam in the same media pool. Now we kind of get to pick and choose our venues. Are you a Fox News guy? Are you a CNN guy? Do you like MSNBC? Do you want to go off and read HuffPo? Or you want to read, you know, whatever segment of the blogosphere you want? So you're not seeing the entire conversation. So even if there are those balancing forces out there or those balancing commentaries, you may not be seeing them just because of the end of the media pool that you're choosing to swim in. The pressure on reporters, or at least the pressure I've always felt through my career, and maybe I'm just extraordinarily fortuitous, maybe I'm extremely naive, but the pressure is to get it right. I have never been so blessed out in my life when I misspelled the name of a state trooper who was giving a briefing on the scene of an explosion in Pennsylvania. And you would have thought I had like ran over to my editor's house and killed her cat. But the pressure has always been to get it right. And the question of, you know, is it terrorism or is it something else? You know, terrorism, that word is a question of motive. More than anything else. What we know is there was an explosion. What we know is that this person has been arrested in connection with that explosion and in connection with the events subsequent to it. What we haven't been able to definitively say is what is that person's motive? You know, we're guessing at it. We're guessing at it through the actions of his brothers and the travels of his brother, but you don't know yet.
Exactly. And so what do we call this process of sifting through evidence and coming up with analytical processes that help us make good evaluations on it. We call it critical faculties. We call it being a public citizen who exercises his or her intellectual skills. And just to circle back around to what we started talking about at the early part of our show, these are precisely the kind of skills that as of right now are under debate and under budget cuts in North Carolina, because our governor is putting forward notions of turning our public universities in the direction of being vocational schools. And many of us are arguing that, no, actually, the job of a public university is to train public citizens who have critical thinking faculties. And one of the times that that comes into play is when we're presented with this flood of information and we have to be able to analyze them and examine their presuppositions and figure out which ones hold water and which ones don't.
And I would say that, too, social media gives and takes. Social media is also a space, and we have lauded it in other circumstances, where people actually are using critical faculties to push back against larger narratives. Now, yes, I can select out of what I watch and don't watch, or who I follow and who I don't. So it can become an echo chamber. But there are ways in which that kind of critical expression can find other people who want to participate in that conversation. And that goes from then just the closed world of social media actually to citizen action.
But does it? And let me ask you about that. What happens, A, when we get it in our head and we got it wrong? How long can these misapprehensions persist, even in the face of, you know, thousands of disclaimers and corrections? People still defaulting to that first thing they saw on Twitter.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting because there was another op-ed in Al Jazeera which sort of invoked the story of Leon Czolgosz, the man who assassinated President McKinley, who was either inspired by anarchist writings and speeches of Emma Goldman, but was also an immigrant from Poland who didn't speak English and who was underemployed, as we would say, and was fighting in some sense. He's a very complex figure, but immediately the Polish community sort of arming themselves against their indictment as the harbor of a foreign citizen at a time, 1901, where the immigrant populations that are coming in from all over, as well as the African-American migration from the South, are changing the nature of larger cities and urban areas. Czolgosz actually appears in a piece of theater, Stephen Sondheim's musical Assassins, which takes this view, is trying to be a self-examination of America's role in producing its own killers, particularly those ones who want to make a huge impact by a political assassination. And the musical was a big flop when it appeared in 1990 because it appeared in the context of the Gulf War. But also there was this backlash against how dare you glorify a murderer. So even though the thrust of the piece is to try and be critical about it, the story so strongly written and supported by evidence in some cases about who these men were and why men and women and why they acted the way they did.
You can't tell another story. It raises the question, though, about what it is we're really looking for. You said in a good play and in media, we want the answer. We want the truth. We don't want the truth. I mean, if you wanted the truth, you certainly wouldn't try them in a military tribunal, would you? You'd never find out. It would stay concealed forever. You would never, as an American citizen, know what happened and why. Do we really want the truth, or do we just want validation or confirmation of whatever prejudices reside? And please don't disturb my bigotry.
Well, I think you're talking about looking for certainty. I mean, if you remember back to 9/11 or any of the big terrorism incidents that we've experienced in this country, what all that media speculation has to do with, what all those jumping to conclusions have to do with is – we know who did it. We know why it did it, and we know it's not going to happen again. We're looking for that sense of certainty that gives us back the sense of safety that was disrupted by this very unusual event. And why is it getting reported more than the other shootings that happen every day? Because it's weird. It's different. It's new, and it disrupts that sense of continuity. And it's sad to say that we as a country have become used to shootings and homicides of a certain type, but we have. It's when this very strange, unusual, foreign type of event happens that we get disrupted and we look for certainty. That's what we're looking for. It's not the truth. It's certainty.
And I think this ability to be able to critique and question and scrutinize precisely what we have gotten way too comfortable with is really important. How foreign are these two suspects if, after all, they've been raised in this country and, you know, 6 months before they were in college parties smoking pot and hitting on girls and getting drunk and what have you. And as somebody who cares about accuracy, not only with respect to Islam and Chechnya and global events, but also in terms of America, mm-hmm. I think one of the things that we are called to do whenever we hear public officials talk about rolling back, let's say, immigration to create this illusion of safety is to actually remind us that, no, we as a country have had these conversations before. We've been there in 1917 when we barred people from Asia from entering this country. We were there in 1924 when we said that we want to preserve, quote, the ideal of homogeneity in America, and you restricted to 2% of the quota from 1890. And we were there in 1965 when we somewhat opened up the doors to immigration. And no, we don't want to go back to 1917. And no, we don't want to go back to 1924, and we are richer by the diversity of the populations that we have. And fundamentally, we're going to hold individuals accountable and responsible for their crimes and not go down the rabbit hole of holding entire blocks of humanity accountable based on their ethnicity or religion. That's not what our American legal system is based on.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Omid Safi is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jules Odendahl James is a resident dramaturg and visiting lecturer at Duke University, and Mark Binker, multimedia investigative reporter at WRAL-TV. Coming up next, the music of Jelly Siso Ho. Stay tuned.